to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Good morning, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and this is a pre-recorded interview for May 10th, 2016. So as everyone knows, we are really going through some serious inward changes, not just from the standpoint of healing, but from the standpoint of how we see things, how we process, how we assimilate. So it's a very exciting time because we really truly are being called to anchor these new energies in our beingness, in the way in which we operate, the way in which we integrate with our own planet. So keep up the good work. Everyone's doing such a great job. And please focus on grounding the light and the energies. Mother Earth and those that are dealing with some of the darker entities very much need our help in this area. Now, I do want to put a call out to not forget about building the pyramids. That message came directly from Saint Germain, and it is very, very important. If you look at the whole purpose of a pyramid that is above and below, you will look into the fact that it is a purification tool. So not only are we clearing a lot of darkness, debris, density, etc., wherever you end up etherically building these, but we're also doing a major purification ceremony every time we undertake this. So please do not forget that. You can access how to do that, what's involved. It's very simple. On the website, there is a widget, I think, on the right column, and it'll teach you everything you need to know. As always, you can check out our blog 365 days a year. If you're familiar with the Galactic Connection blog, you know that we do put out a newsletter each day, And sometimes all the posts do not make it on that newsletter. So I always advise everyone to continue to check back. Okay. We are wanting to be even more so of an intel hub. So for all of you out there who have amazing gifts and guidance, and you know, I'm just so honored to work with all the healers and shamans and practitioners. I mean, you guys are just awesome. Please feel free to send your intel. You will always get credit for it. We will always honor your information. And of course, we will scan it. We don't pass out doomy, gloomy stuff that the sky's falling and the earth is going to fall into the ocean kind of thing, if that's possible. Anyway, so we have so many new exciting things that are about to be introduced. So hang on to your hats. We're pretty excited. I have a new essence line called Removing the Veils. It's an 8-step sequence, and I'm really excited about it. This came to me last year, and I'm just now having the time to be able to release it. We are also going to be releasing our Galactic Energetic Solutions, which is based on assisting your body and your stressors and all the things that have happened to your body in response to the stress of this environment and this world, and how we can help you bring that back to balance. And it is amazing, let me tell you. We also have quite a few other new things percolating, and we've brought in some new volunteers who've really, oh my gosh, have they really helped and lightened the load for me and the team. So we'll talk about that. Jeff Godfrey has a new service that just sounds out of this world. That's really exciting. Jerry Yesko has some new things percolating. So we've got all kinds of cool stuff. So please stay tuned. And just be patient with us. As you know, we're still kind of a skeletal team trying to work this out. Anyway, so hope you guys are as excited as I am. We are going to be doing an interview today with Adam Apollo again. And for those of you who didn't see my last interview with him, please check it out on our YouTube channel. You can also access it through the archives on the website itself. Adam has offered insights on consciousness development, physics, future technologies, and planetary transitions actually at the White House, in a United Nations summit, and at conferences and festivals all around the world. He awoke to a complete library of sacred geometry and metaphysical knowledge at the age of 15 and spent most of his years afterwards teaching and integrating the information through developing deep personal magic, magical and martial arts practices. After being invited to hold counsel with indigenous elders from around the world to private fire ceremonies, Adam Apollo helped to organize 2 prayer runs for world peace across the North American continent and smoked the white buffalo peace pipe passed down 13 generations from the white buffalo calf woman. Wow. In 2005, Adam physically encountered a galactic ambassador from a starship, met ambassadors from 73 species of the Galactic Council through an astral stargate, and recovered memories from several lifetimes before the journey to Earth. So today what we're going to do is we're going to dive in and go a little bit deeper into Camelot and some of the symbology, the meanings behind it, the archetypes, and things like that. I think this is going to be a very interesting interview. If you haven't already checked out Adam's website, it's called the Galactic Alliance. And you can go to adamapollo.info for more information on Adam. With that said, we'll go ahead and jump into the interview. So good morning, Adam. How are you?
Fantastic.
Right on. Good, good. So I thought we could pick up from where we left off. We kind of ended on parts of Camelot that we were intrigued with, how you saw the healing and the actual wounding of the divine masculine and certain situations like that. And for everyone who didn't see part one, make sure you tune into part one, because we're going to hopefully keep a little bit of a thread going between each of these series. Now,
Adam, they say that Camelot is referred to the dreams of lost golden ages. Mm-hmm. You know? And apparently there was even something about a relationship between Camelot and JFK, which I thought was interesting. So I wanted to see through your eyes and your lens, which is always fascinating, where do you think that fits in with where humanity is going today?
Well, I think there's a lot of parallels. When you really look at the conditions of the time back then, and of course, unfortunately, you know, there's not a lot of highly accurate information about what was going down, but at least historically, what you can put together if you pay attention is that, you know, there's a lot of turmoil going on in the islands at that time, the British Islands. And there was a lot of different forces coming in from different places. You have Viking barbarian raids coming in on ships from the north and coming around, attacking places, going in, grabbing women, you know, raping and burning villages, taking what they want and going home. You have Germanic tribe inclusions coming in from the south, you know, meeting with the different peoples again, trying to like anchor a place, make some land theirs, take what they want. And then you also have the infighting that's going on among the different lords and ladies and leaders like around the entire area of the British Isles. And so you're in this hot pot of energies coming together, and there are a lot of very, very intense conflicts happening on a lot of fronts. Now, into this, you know, emerges a spiritual tribe of beings who clearly had the intention of trying to bring harmony back to the land and trying to reconcile these differences between these different diverse groups. And as you unfold the story, and as you gain the insight from especially people like us who are there, you begin to see that the process was one that is very similar to what we're trying to do on the planet right now, which is to look at how these differences, the diversity that exists right now that's creating this, that's a big part of creating this conflict, can also be leveraged and used to bring us together in a greater way than ever before, to create the greatest peace we've ever experienced on the planet. And to do that, we also know that it's not all going to be able to happen simply by physical force and physical leverage. You can't build an army and go, in this time, let's say, go take out the Trump supporters and everything's going to be okay, right? That's not going to solve the problem.
Right.
And so you have to look at a deeper level of the problem. And from a metaphysical standpoint, you want to address what's going on in the root energetics of the issue, the relationship between people and the earth and the environment, their relationship with themselves, their relationship with trauma and fear. Are they getting their basic needs met or not? And if you can address these things and the energetic level of those things on the emotional, mental levels, you know, etheric, astral, cathartic, spiritual, you know, and that kind of thing, then you can make changes in higher levels of the universal structure, and they propagate down into the physical. And so our approach that we had at that time to make these changes, I think, is very much a mirror of the kind of approach we have to take now to bring our planet back into balance.
Do you feel that what was going on within Camelot was also dualistic? Because, you know, you're mentioning a lot of the wars and local, you know, garrisons and tribal conflict and that sort of stuff, that they were literally trying to protect themselves from the outside. What about from internally, from within?
Well, for anybody who's watching this, who's ever worked with a team or created a company, you know that there are many, many different dynamics that come into play when you're doing that. And you have to consider something. You know, a lot of these people involved in these events are soul family, going back for thousands and thousands of years and into other star systems. Some of them have been lovers with each other, or enemies with each other, or brother and sister, or mother and daughter, or father and son, and had many other kinds of relationship dynamics over a very long period of incarnations. And when you look into the flow of time, you begin to see that in each cycle, in each incarnation, there are certain karmic patterns which come up to get re-stimulated in order for deeper level sanskaras to be cleared, both in individuals as well as, you know, within the collective. And in Avalon, I think, was probably the biggest resurfacing of two other previous points in time up until then, which would be, you know, in Egypt, and particularly during the period of Tutankhamun III, all the way through to, Amenhotep III, all the way through to Tutankhamun, and into the period following that, and also from Atlantis. And so there's, as these large event periods go down and a soul family undergoes a serious amount of challenge, trauma, planetary transformation, you know, in Egypt, having lots of your soul family around you being assassinated mm-hmm. before your eyes, and realizing, and the fear that comes up with realizing, like, what can happen when there is an external force that comes in and decides that your magic, your light, your life force, your spirituality is not okay with them, and they're going to destroy you, and because it's too powerful, or it's, you know, that's usually really the problem, is it's too powerful. And that was the problem in Egypt. And the echo there is that, you know, the issue we dealt with was that Akhenaten was used as this beacon to try to unify people under this one God faith. And the general Horemheb at that time, which, you know, I'm not saying Akhenaten was good or bad, but the general, the military general there at the time, leveraged that movement to make an excuse to literally have assassins and people go and kill thousands and thousands of priests and priestesses and destroy temples all over Egypt. Now, that soul family that was there, and many of them that were killed, are again now, you know, in the British Isles, you know, trying to unify the land, trying to bring the peoples together, trying to create peace, reawakening a lot of the old magics to be able to do this successfully. And what comes in? Christianity. Here comes this one God faith thing again, and it's coming right along with the same consciousness that all these other things are evil and the work of the devil, and it's got a different framing, but it's got that same, like, no, you know, we're not going to accept the diversity of divinity in the universe. We're not going to accept the full spectrum here. We want everything to go into this one box, you know, this one route. It's got to be looked at this way. And so if you can imagine the trauma that happened from the slaughter in Egypt, well, when Christianity started flooding through the British Isles, which was happening at the same time that we were building Camelot, you can imagine some of the underlying tensions that created, not to even get into the kinds of tensions that already existed between some members of the soul family trying to work out karmas with each other.
You know, they say that Camelot was begun by Joseph of Arimathea. Mm. And the story goes that he originally saw it as an Islamic city. Mm. And apparently he left, and when he came back, it had turned into a Christian city.
Mm. Yeah.
There was like some, there was a St. Stephen's the Martyr church built right in the center of Camelot. I was curious what you thought about that. Like, what would be the significance of that part of the story?
Yeah, it's very interesting assessment. I think that the Islamic link is particularly interesting because in terms of the different cultures in the world that have effectively, in my opinion, expressed the wisdom of the divine geometry in form, Islamic buildings, Islamic churches, Islamic temples, I would say have some of the most powerful visual expressions of beauty in the world of any kinds of churches. And it's because, you know, they're not iconic, they're not humanified, you know, they're not turned into one kind of being or another. They're literally fractal expressions of geometry and beauty unfolding themselves, the perfect mathematics, the perfect dynamics, and they would always allow there to be imperfections as well. So when you're looking at it, it looks absolutely perfect, but they allow the imperfections and even hold space for those to work themselves into the mandalas so that it's all accepting, you know? And so I feel energetically there's a synchronization there in any case.
Fascinating. Where, now give us an example of the imperfections of a mandala.
Yeah. So for example, let's say you've got a guy and he's doing a tile work with a thousand diamond shapes, you know, that are forming pentagonal, hexagonal, heptagonal lattices, you know, dodecagonal lattices, and they're going out. But as they're going out, one of the tiles is partially chipped or, you know, isn't quite the right shape. And so what they do is they just like go ahead and lay it in there. Instead of replacing the tile, they lay the imperfect tile in there. And the only place you would see the imperfection would be right around that tile as the shape would change a tiny bit. But within the bigger picture, it always comes back into perfect alignment, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like allowing there to be those imperfections. And that's a deep wisdom in the Islamic faith.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I've never thought of it that way. That's beautiful. So the whole Camelot story is always tied in with the search for the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And there are so many references to what the Holy Grail is. In fact, they've said that it could be an extraterrestrial device that fell from heaven like a stone, mm-hmm. That it could be a cauldron, it could represent the chalice itself, or even the womb of Mary to carry on the bloodline. What do you think about that?
Well, I think to really get into the Grail, we have to go back further. We have to really journey back in time and uncover some of the deeper origins of this peoples that came to the British Isles and that eventually, you know, wove through the Druid faiths and eventually created Avalon and eventually created Camelot and eventually, in many ways, faded due to the pressing influence of Christianity coming into that space. When you go back further, there is a series of key events that unfold themselves as sort of the roots behind these stories. If you look at the best theoretical work, as well as the channeled work and the memory work, some of which I've done and others, recalling the events at the end of the Age of Atlantis, what you find is that if the flood story indeed happened and the end of the Ice Age did occur at that time, you have this massive flooding and a massive distribution of people around the world. If there's a global society at this point, that global society gets very strongly divided. And places that are going to be wiped out by tidal waves, by the ocean rising, for example, the place where I was during the Age of Atlantis, we knew that tidal waves were coming, and there were people that left on ships and went out deep into the ocean and went into the highlands in the other land masses nearby to be able to go in and take as much sacred knowledge as possible and take it to places where it would be protected and safe. And so many different of our different tribes from different cities and civilizations inside of the Atlantean global civilization distributed themselves and went to these different places. Now, at some point after this, it is uncertain. There's no very, very clear historical knowledge of exactly when some of these groups arrived in different places. It's clear that some of them may have been in one place for a few thousand years and then traveled to another place and then traveled to another place. But my assessment at this point is that there was many different groups. And one of those groups shows up in the British Isles. Scholars estimate around 2000 BC or something, but it's, again, I don't think that's highly accurate necessarily. And the story goes that the people who are called the Tuatha De Danann, the people of Danu, basically arrived in the British Isles, and the original stories describe them as riding clouds coming in. And they arose riding these clouds, which scholars say, well, maybe it was like there was ships burning and they were attacking and there was smoke or something. But it's not the words that the person that wrote this used. You know, they came riding clouds and they arose on the land, came in and met with the people. And what they brought with them is they brought these four sacred treasures. And they told the people as they began to come in and integrate with this culture that these four sacred treasures were being brought along with them with this wisdom that's coming from these three islands in the sky. And this is the words that actually get translated and passed down, that they were bringing these tools from these three islands in the sky. Now, what islands exist in the sky that we know of? Planets, right? Like there's other planetary systems. Now, these four treasures, I think you'll find are particularly interesting. The four treasures are the seed elements of the four tarot cards that we use today. There is the Dagda's cauldron, which is a massive chalice, first and foremost. It is literally a grail or a chalice or a cauldron, a bowl in which things can be created and manifested. There's the spear of Luk, and the spear of Luk is generally thought of by other scholars or retranslated perhaps in the future as being the spear that pierced Jesus's body, and that whoever holds the spear and goes into battle with it cannot lose a battle. Now, this spear probably was a different kind of artifact and probably was not the same spear that pierced Jesus's body, but that the story around the spear being the one that pierced Jesus's body was the explanation for why this spear had this power. And my knowledge of the spear is that it was an artifact of integrity, meaning that if you held the spear with full integrity, then you were in full alignment with purpose, and so your army could not lose. But if you held the spear and you were out of alignment, you were immediately lose the spear. Yeah. The spear would not stay with you. There was the Stone of Fall, which is the root of the Pentacles suit in the tarot, and also is connected to the diamonds in the Atlantean symbolic tarot, which we call playing cards. Mm-hmm. The hearts of spring is the chalices, the clubs, which is the full grown tree actually of the summer, is the staff or the stave or the spear. The stone is also the pentacle, like it's a crystal, basically. Crystal stone is a pentacle, is a diamond. And then finally, there is the sword of light. And it's often called the sword of light of Nuada, which is the name of the king of the Tuatha De Danann that brought the people to the British Isles at this time. And the sword of light is the sword. It's also the spade, which is also the tree of winter, which is also the symbol of total integration, crystallization, and forging. Like what happens to us in the winter is we forge deeper who we are. And the sword of light eventually, in other stories, reemerges as Caliburn. And Caliburn eventually is retranslated and re-pronounced as Excalibur. And so within this set of these four treasures, you have these key wisdom elements of these the dynamics of energy, of manifestation, of truth, of creation. There have been parallels between the Stone of Fall and other stones, or possibly the same stone, which may have been held in the Ark of the Covenant, for example. And that these different tools were really representations and or actual physical models of galactic tools that were brought to this planet, galactic technologies that were brought to this planet. And when we move through time down into the stories of the emergence of Uther Pendragon and subsequently Arthur, what you see is that during this time, there is this massive need for reconnecting with something more powerful than our human nature and our human drive. And how do we re-access, how do we reconnect with the truth of who we are? And how do we call forward, you know, for these early stewards, such as Uther, how do we call forward the soul family that can actually make the transformation happen in these lands and on this planet? And so the way forward to do that, you know, which of course the Merlin or a Merlin of that time would have deduced, would be to find or to recover one of the sacred treasures. You know, to recover one of these tools will enable the people to unite, to come around a single goal, to come around a single point of light. And of course, the first tool to reemerge in that journey was the sword Caliburn, the sword of light. Yes. And that sword being a tool that first Uther would use to be able to try to unify the people. But Uther's ego and the challenges at that time and the lack of other soul family, the lack of the women uniting with him, left a lot wanting with Uther's cycle.
You know, so, Adam, I was going to ask you about Uther, the whole point of Ygritte, right? The fact that she was married to another king and he fell madly in love with her and couldn't even live a day without her, they say, and just became obsessed and then went to Merlin and said, I you have to do something. And then there's that whole storyline of they shapeshifted him into the king so that she thought that she was making love to her husband when it was actually Uther.
Yeah.
The big hit I got from that whole piece of it was the danger of the spell. And yeah. I was curious what you thought about that. You know, the danger of not only just the spell of not being able to stay in complete, I don't know if the word control is properly used, but to be able to stay in the position of control regarding your own sexuality.
Yeah, it's a complicated piece of the story. From my experiences at that time and from the work that I've done to recover other people's memories of that time, I know those individuals in this time, and it's clear to me that there's a soul relationship between Uther and Egrain that goes back way, way, way before this.
Okay.
And that this series of events was part of a soul contract that they made with each other to do it. And Egrain loved him. She loved Uther, and there was a massively deep connection between them. Uther would not have been so blindly impassioned and taken by her if there wasn't a mutual connection between them. And there was.
And they ended up together after her husband was killed by Uther, right?
That's right. I mean, it wasn't a strange thing for them to deeply desire each other. And it was her desire for him, and him seeing that as she danced, you know, in this one experience where a bunch of the lords came together and they had a big party and they were trying to work out peace agreements. And, you know, Uther sees Egrain dancing and is just completely spellstruck by her and, you know, moved by her at such a deep level that it unlocked one of the key patterns that had to unfold for the series of events to unfold. It's like, you know, if your souls plan some stuff out and you work some things out with the spirit world in advance, you have to set up trigger points where that will happen. Yeah. And this is why it was, this is why the Merlin helped at that time to do this, because he'd already foreseen that this would be necessary and that something would come of this union between them that was going to help the rebirth of the dragon happen. You know, it was going to help the Pendragon come forth and the spirit of the dragon to come back into the land and to reunify the people.
That's interesting too, because, Uther was childless and had not been able to pass on his lineage and have a son, which was always so desired back then. And
that's
then,
right.
And then she ended up giving him a son, right?
Could you say that last sentence again? Because you just froze for a brief second.
She ended up giving him a son after all, which was Mordred, right?
Yeah, so there's a few layers that then unfold. So if you look at the flow around Egwene at that, or Egwene, Egrain at that time, you can see that there's a preparation happening. She's magically trained, she's connected to the ladies of Avalon. She's moved on. She's with this Duke, you know, but she has a purpose to fulfill. And the women of Avalon are like, you have this purpose to fulfill. And so is it realistic to think that when Uther came and he had a spell to be able to get into the castle and he's making love to her, that she was just like not there and didn't know that it was Uther? The answer is, I think not. She knew it was Uther, and she was, you know, open to him and in love with him. And that love that was forged between them in that moment was the key to birthing Arthur, because they're a soul family with Arthur, and their energetic soul constructs were aligned just so. And both of them had relationships with Arthur in Egypt and also previously in Atlantis. And so the connection and the love between this family had to be strong enough to bring through more soul family. And so that's a little bit of the headlines there. And you mentioned Mordred. I may not have heard your sentence before that.
No, because I messed up, because Mordred was with Arthur and his stepsister. Whereas you're right. I completely messed
up. So in that piece of the story, which I'm happy to clarify elements of as well, what went down, I think Marianne Zimmer Bradley actually does a good job articulating this part. I haven't read her full series, but I've done that intentionally so that I don't, you know, I don't want to distort my own memories as I'm working out the whole pattern of events. So Igraine has another child, and she has a daughter, and this daughter grows up, and for all the period of time in which Arthur is growing up, he's not with his family. He's sent away immediately by the recommendations of the Merlin and by the women of Avalon that he be kept safe, because it is an absolute storm around Uther. And it is a not safe place for this child to be, because any one of the other lords that was trying to take charge would have killed the child immediately. So Arthur is kept secret, and he's hidden in a small village. He grows up in this small village, and in the time period that he's there, he knows almost nothing of who he is, where he came from. He doesn't know anything about his parents. All he knows is the words of his caretaker and keeper, a man he considers his uncle, and his cousin, which he considers his brother, because, you know, they're just family.
And this is such a key part, Adam, isn't it? It's a very key part that he doesn't know his lineage.
That's right. And it's intentionally done that way. And also, in the case of Hector, his uncle, it's important that Arthur not be caught up in whatever that is that went down. And there's a lot of trauma, and there's a lot of intensity, and a lot of misunderstanding. You know, people didn't understand the whole thing between Uther and Igraine. People didn't understand, you know, how her husband was killed, and then why he's suddenly with her, and like what all these pieces of the puzzle went down from the public standpoint. Mm-hmm. It's crazy, you know, like it's crazy stuff. Like, this man's trying to become king. He's got this magical sword, you know, it's like, these are not things that the everyday people of those times were easily able to translate and understand. Right. And so it was better that he was kept out of that, but it didn't stop the fact that there were still very, very intense things going on. For example, his village being raided by barbarians at one point, and them burning down parts of the village, and, you know, and hiding underneath the floors in a room, you know, and then having to escape in the night, and finally Hector, you know, realizes that they need to return to his castle, and so he brings Arthur, you know, to his castle where he could train more with his brother Kay and become a better warrior. And, you know, his whole vision at that point, because of the way of the times, was that Arthur was going to be basically the apprentice to Kay, and Kay was going to become a knight, and Arthur was going to be the knight's squire, and that was it. But that's all that Arthur could dream of at that time.
Well, Adam, they say that he was very kind of scrawny and skinny and not very strong at that point, right?
Yeah, he was a little guy. And no one would have ever thought he was the son of Uther, because Uther was a monster. He was a beast.
Yeah.
You know, the guy was just ripped, ridiculous. And so, you know, there are other pieces of the story that are also missing from the history. There are times where, you know, during this period of growing up, you know, kids fall in love, people fall in love. And Arthur had lovers. He had in particular one woman that he was lovers with that ended up becoming pregnant. But she became pregnant in the same time when Hector was needing to move them again for safety. And so Arthur at that time didn't even know that he impregnated a woman and was on to the next place. But this becomes a very, very important piece of the story later on, because later a very deep missing piece of the story is when Arthur discovers that he has this daughter and realizes that he's going to try to recover her, and he's going to try to bring her back into his life. And this is during the period, during the seeking of the Grail, when the kingdom is falling apart, when the structures are falling apart after betrayal and things like that have gone down. And we can get to that point in the story a little bit later if you want. But, you know, at some point there's a crossroad of destiny that occurs. And the crossroad of destiny begins to happen as the fighting intensifies, and there's battle, more and more battles going on and going down between the different tribes. And it's not enough for Arthur to be a squire anymore. He has to go in and he has to fight and battle. And as he begins going into these battles, it's just hardcore times, you know, it's very hardcore times, but Arthur shows his proficiency and he's got skills and he's good, but he also ends up getting struck in one of these battles and he's wounded, and he climbs his way out of the battle and finds his way under a bridge where he can rest and try to take care of the wound and stay hidden. And at this point in time, he's starting to question everything. Nothing is making sense anymore. I mean, the way that he looks, the way that people are looking at him, the kind of experiences that he's starting to have, the hints he's obviously picked up on over the years and years, that something's off. Somebody's lying to him. Somebody's not telling him the truth. Who's his parents? Where did he come from? Like, this isn't his blood brother. He doesn't look anything like him. That's not his father. Like, there's this burning, consuming questioning that is eating Arthur alive for years.
And also, Adam, part of it too is he was not well received because he was considered to be a bastard son.
That's, you know, right.
From some of the stories that you read, he was maligned and teased relentlessly by his peers and kind of treated like the stepchild.
Yeah, he was in many ways, but that was also intentional on Hector's part to dismiss him, to make him seem like he's not important, because that was part of the way that Hector was going about protecting him. Maybe it wasn't the most loving way to raise someone, but that was Hector's first prerogative. That was given to him by the Merlin. That was given to him by the priestesses. He had to protect this boy. And he was going to keep him out of battles if he could. He was going to keep him as a squire in the background. Do not go, you know, Arthur. But Arthur was, you know, as the questions burned through him, as he discovered this wellspring of wisdom inside of him and began to actually express that through the sword and through his movement and through his energy, he knew inside that he had to help. He had to do something. So he went in to battle and he went to help his brother and he fought. And unfortunately, in one of those battles, pretty early on, he gets struck. And this wound leaves him, you know, under this bridge, and a woman comes and rides over to him on a horse, and she jumps down and she sees him and she pulls out herbs, and he looks at her, and immediately there's a soul spark connection between them. And this connection is like obviously ancient and is really, it's from Egypt. That was the previous time that these two had really connected. And this woman basically patches his wound and puts salve on it and creates this thing, but it's, you know, it's deep. And she says, I need you to come with me. And I can bring you somewhere where we can help you. When she recognizes him, she knows who he is. And so, you know, he accepts because He doesn't want to go back in the battle. He doesn't want to go back to the home where he's lied to, where he's dismissed. Doesn't want to go back into this world that he's in that's totally not in alignment with the truth that he knows inside of himself. And so he gets on the horse with her, and he rides with her, and is taken to the island of Babylon. He's taken to the lake and brought across on the boat, and he arrives in this place that's these different caves that are built into cliffs and brought up the trails and taken into this place where there's all women. It's all women around him. And he is like, where am I? Because, you know, there's the women around where he's used to, it's like they're always the maids, you know, or these like, you know, livery women or whatever. Occasionally there's like a queen or a lady, but you never see them because they're always like hidden. And it was like women, oh my God, you know, and not just women, but women that were obviously powerful women.
And supposedly didn't he grew up in like, you know, kind of out in the country.
Oh yeah. Backwoods.
In more of a township type environment.
Totally.
Not a lot of money, you know.
No, these were women that had made such incredible robes. I mean, he thought he was transported to another planet. It was like arriving, you know, you can imagine someone arriving somewhere and everybody looks so different from anybody you've ever been around that you're just like, and you are wounded and you're like passing out and the trip and stuff, and you wake up, you're like, is this a dream? Am I, you know, like... And so he comes into this place, and he has to he first has to go through this healing process, and they use magic and they use these things and they start to heal him. And then they he offers them, how can I be of service to you? You know, how can I serve you in return for doing this for me and for saving my life?
Which is exactly what they wanted to hear, right?
Exactly. And so they begin giving him tasks. You know, he's got to do this, haul wood, chop water, you know, chop wood, carry water, make the thing, build this, do that. But as that's happening and he's in this place, he's also beginning to remember who he is. Being around these women is sparking all these soul memories inside of him.
Wow.
He's seeing women and they're echoing these like memories inside of him. He's having experiences going up on top of the rocks where he's under the stars and seeing starships, seeing connections with beings. And he begins to recall his Egyptian self, and he begins to recall his Atlantean self, and he begins to recall these other ley line points in his timeline. And the dragon inside of him begins to awaken. And so as he's doing this service and they're teaching him little things, he also starts teaching them things. And the more he begins to teach them and share with them his knowledge of magic and wisdom as it's emergent from him, the more they begin to see that he actually can possibly step into this leadership role and unify the men of the land and start to forge the circles. He had to mature into this place.
Now, Adam, what was the name of the woman that found him, that took him to Camelot?
You know, I don't know what her name was in that time.
And was she like somebody that just played a role at that point, or did she kind of fade through the rest of the story?
She was a key priestess in the circles of Avalon, and she played many roles around different points in time with the other priestesses throughout the story. So, but she also was the kind of person that she wears cloaks. You know, you wouldn't notice her unless she wanted you to. And whether she made it into the sort of historical stories and pieces like that or not, I don't know that for sure.
The reason I asked is because supposedly he had three half-sisters.
Hmm.
I was curious if she might have been one of them, you know. I don't know.
It is possible. Yeah, I've definitely there's definitely pieces of that which, you know, it's
still murky.
There is some uncertainty around who all Uther was with and who all Egrain was with and who was exactly sired by who. Especially with Uther's children, there were things that were obviously kind of could be confused. Let's just put it that way.
Well, no, I totally agree, because even in the his story stuff, okay, that's out there. I'm glad you brought that up. I pulled up family trees of King Arthur, and every single one of them is different.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen them, but some of them, you know, Uther had more than just the two that we hear about.
Yeah.
And in others, it actually shows that he has brothers and sisters. So it depends on which version you're talking about. And I think Ralph Ellis said there's about 70 different versions of Camelot.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets a little messy back in there for sure. But there are a few things that are definitely certain. And that one of, if not, you know, if there were three sisters, which is very likely that there were.
Especially with the three, huh?
Three is generally a pretty good number. There's definitely a very strong relationship that Arthur has with one of those sisters. And the way that it unfolded was that there were celebrations that these women did for each one of the eight gateways of the year. You know, they honored the old Tuatha traditions and the Druid traditions, which was acknowledging every moon cycle, acknowledging every one of the gates of the year, charting and calendaring and recording the magical cycles and weaving those and leveraging those and using those to do the work that they were doing, which was a subtle way of moving nations and moving lords and ladies and helping to kind of steer events from afar. A very good analog for the kind of work that they were doing is in Robert Jordan's series, The Wheel of Time. For any readers that are familiar with that, there's a place called the White Tower where the Ez Sedai live. And the Ez Sedai is this group of women, priestesses, magi, who, you know, steer the flows of nations because they have this power and this majesty and self-control. And they're very similar to the priestesses of Avalon during that time. And, you know, during these celebration times, the women would also go into towns. They would go into villages and they would celebrate with the people. And they would find in these celebrations new women that were ready to be initiated and that kind of thing. And so there were different events and parties and things like that. And one of these events, of course, is Beltane. Now, at a certain initiation juncture point for Arthur, he participates in one of these Beltane rituals. And in that time, there was a traditional event where the men go to hunt the great stag. You know, the men go to find the king stag, and the first man that comes back with the king stag to feed the people would be the, you know, blessed as the king of Beltane or whatever, and get to make love to the queen of Beltane, who is a woman who would be chosen within the circle of women and blessed up and cared for and prepared for this sacred ritual, which was a fertility ritual where the divine masculine and the divine feminine come together and make love, and it gives the gift and enables and entices everyone else to make love and to create this amazing fertility for the land and to birth it so that the land would be very fertile and there'd be lots of crops in the fall. And so in this particular Beltane experience, Arthur does take the king stag and drags it back and brings it in and then is basically, you know, put into this mask, and he wears this mask, and he's brought into this chamber where there's a woman laying there in a mask who's all, you know, buttered up and ready for him. And they make love, and they have this powerful, you know, soul connection, love making experience that's like, you know, earth shattering energetically. And then it's done. And, you know, as time passes from that moment, Arthur is oblivious to anything around that. That was just like, it was just this epic thing. And it was this woman, and he wishes he knew who she was. And, you know, he didn't get to see the other women naked that often, so he couldn't identify her body, you know, and her face was completely covered, you know. And so, you know, he doesn't know for a long, long time, but she ends up finding out. She knows who he was, and she could identify him because he was shirtless a lot, you know. He was like, it was like, oh my God. And she comes to realize and know that he's her brother.
I can't imagine the level of betrayal that was felt on both of their parts.
Well, for her, she managed it, I would say, extremely well.
Wow.
She did a really good job holding it down. And she also understood, though. She understood all the dynamics. She understood why, you know, why Arthur was brought there, why this cycle happening, why these whole things, even though she didn't know her personal relationship with him until later, it was like she saw the pattern, and she saw how all of these things were being laid out. But she also knew that the women who were, you know, leading the ceremony of choosings, you know, no one could know that Arthur would pull that king stag out. Except that when you read the cards, it was almost inevitable. He was maturing. He was ready to be the leader. He was ready, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like in the magical cards, of course it's going to be Arthur that gets the stag. So why did the women choose like the most powerful young woman at that time who like was his sister? It's like, why would you... And that's the part where she realized that these women were not everything that she thought. She realized that they didn't have all knowing, because why would they do that to her? You know, and why would they do that to him?
I was going to ask you too, like, what do you feel was their intention of what would come out of it versus the fact that it was Mordred who ended up fatally wounding Arthur in the end? So, radically different as far as what came out of it and what was intended. I'd like to know what you thought about that.
Yeah, I think that their intention, was to forge a bloodline that was really, really strong. Like to forge a soul bloodline, lineage line that was going to be extremely strong, you know, and be able to carry it for generations ahead, and also to be prepared in case, for some reason, Arthur gets killed before he's able to actually unify the lands. So if Arthur dies, then there needs to be a backup plan, which is would be to have one of those most powerful young priestesses birth a child who also has this some of these same lineage lines that could possibly take the lead. But of course, they would have no idea that the kind of way that would disturb Arthur's sister so deeply and eventually disturb Mordred so much as well. You know,
the Adam, I think what I bet you there's a bunch of us listening to that have the same question. We've all read in particular European history that one of the main reasons that the bloodlines were so maniacal and unstable, not as intelligent, is because they continued to have brother and sister merge and create a child.
Yeah, it's a misinterpretation of what lineage actually is. It's a loss of the understanding that originally the king's lines and that whole process was the divine right of kings, right? And divine right of queens in turn, is something that is a gift given by the divine. It's like when there is an ordainment wherein a soul and a family, you know, agree together that someone is the power for that level of leadership. And there's magic that happens. The universe moves in order to facilitate the synchronistic flow to allow for something to happen, for a big change to occur, and that an individual can be the vehicle for that, especially in the age of Pisces, which we've been in.
Right.
It's been extremely easy for there to be a single point for everybody to rally around, you know?
Why do you say especially Pisces? Is that because Pisces is like the related to the karma or the old wounds?
It's because in the age of Pisces, spirituality is generally oriented around a guru or a teacher. In contrast to the age of Aquarius, where spirituality is oriented around the individual.
Yes.
And so most astrologers interpret the age of Pisces as the age of the avatars, where, you know, there is a one person, and of course there's avatars throughout all time, but in especially through the age of Pisces, the idea of the guru or the spiritual teacher, that one person that you go to and lay down all your suffering with in order to achieve your awakening, was extremely strong. Now, later on, you know, the Rite of Kings became thought of as blood and a bloodline thing, where it's like father, son, whatever. But blood is not, it's what's really meant by the bloodline is the soul line, you know, in these older texts. And it's about who the beings are that are incarnating more than the blood. But the blood, you know, also there's the connection that I think is part of what made the misinterpretations eventually, which is the awareness that, you know, that in the flow of these galactic species coming into the planet in the time of Atlantis and spreading and, you know, becoming parts of these different tribes of different star families, the Tuatha comes to the British Isles and they are elves. I mean, they are straight up elven. They're Syrians, you know, and they show up and they've got magical tools and they're bringing the Syrian wisdom and they're bringing the weaving of the fields and the Celtic knotwork and how to create sustaining energetic fields and all of this stuff. And so, you know, of course, different beings are going to incarnate into that bloodline who have a lot of those elven Syrian qualities. And so, for example, Arthur incarnates between Uther and Igraine because they're both Syrian. They both have very strong Tuatha bloodline going back to the Syrian star system. And so it's an easy, you know, it's an easy way for that soul to come in and incarnate.
So what's the significance of the dragon, the fact that he's called Pendragon? Now, before you even answer that, I do know that Ralph Ellis, who just released this amazing piece of work on all of this and has tied the Camelot story almost directly at the same historical time period as the Mary Magdalene Yeshua story, by the way. Lots of overlapping there. But yeah, one of the things that he was talking about was the significance of the dragon. Mm-hmm. So how does that play in with the elfin and the Syrian bloodline?
Yeah, well, that takes the story back even older. It's very important actually for where we're at in the kind of timeline of retelling this story to people. During this period when Arthur is fully waking up and there's a big transition point for the women where they realize, like, okay, he's the king stag now. He's ready. He can be a leader. Now it's time to gather the other men. And so, you know, during this period, Arthur has to go out and basically go into battles where there's men fighting and fight, show up, you know, fight for one side or the other, whichever he thinks is the more appropriate one. And while doing this, identify who are the men that fight with honor, with presence, with the Jed. You know, who are the men who are the Jedi that are fighting and that really show up as beacons of light and honor? And he would know as soon as he began fighting one of them, because it was a different kind of fighting. It wasn't fighting to kill. It wasn't fighting to win. It was fighting as an art to understand your opponent, understand yourself. And when he'd find one of these men and he'd battle them full on, you know, they would come to these points of meeting and acknowledging each other. And nobody knew who he was. He like came out of nowhere. He looks different. You know, he's like a man now. And some of these men would literally stop right there and swear on their sword to be in service to him. Because it was that level of like energy connecting them, you know. And for some, it was just enough to stop fighting and for him to be able to talk to them and to say, I want to bring you to this very special place. Like, you're important. And he'd bring them there. And these guys who were like, you know, what the heck is this? You know, and then there's like, oh my God, look, I've hit the jackpot. This place is, look at all these women, you know, like, and find themselves. But they were men who, you know, they were fundamentally different in the level that they had remembered who they were. To some extent, they knew themselves. They knew they had a deeper purpose than the crap that they were being thrown into.
Right.
And then when they'd show up with these women, it was like obvious that their purpose was about to be fulfilled. Like the magic, the synchronicities. I mean, it was blowing everybody away how much magic was happening and beauty. And so as this flow came in, and as this first seating circle of men came together, eventually the women organized an event in which would basically be the coronation of Arthur. And because they made sure that all of the men, first of all, knew that they were strong, independent, and going to be honored for themselves, and second, wanted to know that if Arthur led them to go back to create peace, if they would follow him. And when they knew that everyone there would, without Arthur knowing, they set up a ceremony. And he's brought up into the stone circle on the top of the mountains. And these priestesses, you know, including his sister and the woman that healed him, and another woman that I call the Lady of the Stone because I don't know what her name was at that time either, basically do a coronation with him and all the priestesses around and everyone they had gathered, and they name him king. And at that point, it's time, and that's when the sword is resurfaced. They go to gather the Lady of the Lake, and she is also at this time, not by the way, being living in the lake, but she is one of the key people that has basically been orchestrating and identifying some of these different knights and men and where Arthur should go and the things that should happen. And she's a keeper of at least this, of the sacred treasures.
Now, question, you said that they did the coronation in a circle, a stone circle.
Yes.
I've read a little bit about Stonehenge having some connection to this, where supposedly that was where some of the old knights and kings were buried. Do you feel there's any validity to that?
I imagine that's definitely true. I imagine that there have been many ceremonies similar to this, coronations and funerals, etc., done with great leaders at Stonehenge. This particular stone circle I know was not Stonehenge.
Different location altogether.
Different location, but yes. But yes, absolutely. The stone circles are stargates. And as stargates, they're places where there can be a witnessing that happens, you know, where either man witnesses star family and receives wisdom from the star family and calls on assistance to do great energetic work on the planet, and vice versa, for star family to witness humanity and to see us, and to know us, and gain our wisdom as well.
Adam, why stones? Why did they use stones? Why not crystals?
Stones are crystals.
Well, I know, but denser.
Yeah, bigger, though. You know, it's hard to find, since the time of Atlantis, it's hard to find, unless you go to very specific caverns in the planet, it's hard to find massive pillars of crystal. And so the closest you have is like, what are the most crystallized igneous rock, you know, or but pressure developed rock, like granites and things like that, that you have. And they basically, you know, taking these highly, highly pressure developed rocks that are going to last a long time, that are basically crystals, and then standing them and setting them upright as pillars, you know, to connect, and doing so in exact, you know, mathematical formulas in relationship with the stars, in relationship with the earth. There's a lot of wisdom that ancient tribes and cultures had that is not very well articulated in our current archaeology. The belief that we've been evolving from these kind of barbaric beings is just simply not true. There is knowledge and magic that since those times has been lost, and since the time of Atlantis. And, you know, there is definitely truth also to the fact that there is extraterrestrial involvement. Doesn't mean a starship came in and set up the stones for everybody, but the wisdom in the connection and the communications allows for those kinds of structures to be built. A lot of the big megalithic structures on the planet were built with star knowledge. But I mean, saying that is just saying they're built with ancient knowledge, because at some point those people were star beings, probably, you know, in most cases, or were working with them. And so, you know, it's just important to mention that as an aside, that, you know, our technological knowledge these days is just different than the technological knowledge of those days.
Yeah, I bet. And I know that, like, from the work that Tellinger's done out of Africa, he's proven that these rocks were used a great deal for actual musical instruments, as well as tone and sound. Yeah. That they ring like a bell. So
he's rung one right in front of me. It's quite astounding. You take a piece of this, the specific type of basalt, and he basically can hit it, and it'll just ring. It's like jing, just like this beautiful sound. And there's literally hundreds of thousands of entire, like, spider webbing wall structures, you know, woven across of all of South Africa. I mean, literally.
I saw it when I was there. And in fact, I was eating lunch, looked up at the hill behind me, behind the person I was eating with, and I was just blown away. I had to take a double look, and I'm like, oh my God, that's what Tellinger's been talking about. And there were literal rings that you could see that were still left over.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. So, you know, it makes people look at rocks in a whole different way. I am obsessed with rocks. I collect rocks. I my husband does too. What do you think about that? Why is that?
Well, stone spirits are great allies. You know, they contain ancient wisdom. And, you know, if you think of trees as being hard drives, you know, where they're actually literally growing as rings, storing the data of the environment and energy around them every single year as they add a ring. And they're literally recording all the information that's happening all around them, like a disk, like a hard drive. And elves knew that. Assyrian elves from there, like, we know about the tree hard drives. We know how to access their wisdom and their knowledge as part of the ancient library of the planet, which is why you would never cut down an ancient tree. Like, it would be ridiculous. Like, you have no idea what you're losing when you cut down a big tree. Like, it's just astounding. And stones are the same way, except for they have a different way of storing information. It's like when they surface, it's when energy and information travels through the planet. But especially when they're surfaced, you know, and they have the potential to resonate with the sound and the energy and the light that's going on to them, they can store data also. Yeah. And data can also be cleared from them. And so because they act a little bit more like, instead of a hard drive, it's more like RAM, you know, like it can take in data, hold that data for some amount of time, and then replace that data. But there's also crystal structures in some stones that may hold data for millions of years, you know, and it's there. We already know that's there in the atomic structures, because otherwise how could we carbon date a stone to being millions of years old? There's data there, obviously, that is being stored over that amount of time. So they can act both as RAM, like replacing information and exchanging it, and also as like long-term archive hard drives, you know, that will just carry information for millions of years. So
it's amazing how much our environment, nature around us, provides us everything we need.
Yes.
You know, it provides so much of what we need. So, okay, so back to where you left off. And you were talking about after the coronation.
Yeah.
And he became king. So what happened after that?
Yeah. So Arthur then at that point is the time of the calling of the mission. But during that coronation ceremony, there is an echo of consciousness that comes up, because it's at that point that it's revealed to Arthur after that coronation that his parents, who his parents were, that his father was Uther, that his mother was Igraine, that, you know, that he has a lineage, and that it's appropriate for him to be this person. And the awakening inside of him is massively echoed by the name Pendragon, and the awareness that since he started waking up, he was having visions of dragons. He was having visions of these silver dragons and these aspects of the energy in the land. When the Merlin would come to visit and do trainings with him while he was living there in Avalon and training with the women, there were often pieces of magic and knowledge that were imparted that involved the dragon of the land and how to connect with the dragons in the land. But where this really arises from, going back to your original question around the dragons, is that the lineage of these soul family, this group of star beings that were here, that were forging this round table of men and women, of knights and priestesses, the sword and chalice, that went back to Egypt, that went back to Atlantis, that went back to other star systems, eventually goes back to a time that I talk about a lot in my interview with Alfred Weber and my larger galactic research project, which is the time of the Shehali. And even before the Shehali, where the Shehali are the species that the reptilians came and assaulted, it's clear that there was a soul relationship with those beings that goes back even before that to the Andromeda Galaxy, in which this family of beings were all dragons, literally incarnated massive dragons, like the ones that you see in Dungeons and Dragons, you know, many different kinds of dragons. And this entire race of dragon beings there, and, you know, without spending an hour getting into the details of what went down, the short version is that at some point the Arcturians are trying to bridge the dragon wisdom and knowledge with the humanoid wisdom. And so they take some dragon DNA that they're able to get, and they start doing experiments, merging that dragon DNA with different humanoid species and creating hybrids. And then they put them on a planet and they let them experiment and grow, and they plant more of them there, and they have children, and they're studying them over a couple centuries. And the species massively, super quickly evolves and becomes this very diverse group of beings that we call today, and that many channels call, the reptilians. And sometimes they're called draconians, which obviously refers to the fact that they came from the dragons, although this piece of the story is often lost. And what happens is these reptilians, as the dragon beings that incarnate into the species, because they follow their own bloodline, they follow those genetic lines and bloodlines, and they start incarnating as these reptilian beings, they're completely pissed off and upset because they've gone from being these massive, powerful, magical beings with the ability to literally resonate the fabric of space and warp space-time around them to being in these little confined raptor bodies that are just simply, like, you know, just not going to cut it for some of these massive, amazing beings. And a lot of them are kind of deformed, and they're not, you know, it's like these were interesting genetic combinations and they didn't always work out very well. And then at the same time, you have all these humanoid souls that have been living in peaceful planets, totally like in just, you know, heaven, literally, you know, and then they're incarnating into these reptilian bodies following some of their genetic lines. And they're like, what the heck is happening, you know? And so the dragon lords are like, raw, and then the other reptilians are like, ah, you know, and immediately they create these slave master hierarchies where all of the soul seeds that came in from this from around this galaxy all end up becoming slave workers to these reptilian lord overlords, which are the dragons, which are way more powerful and are also extremely pissed off that they've incarnated here.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, you know, and you've got all these dynamics in the reptilians where they're like, the way they show that they're powerful is to take power from each other and to overcome each other with strength, because they're always trying to show that they're the big guys, you know, that they are still those big dragons, even though they're stuck in these little crappy bodies in some other galaxy, right? And so they destroy their own planets and each other, and then they travel to other planetary systems, and the first one that gets raided is the Shehali. Now, when this goes down, what happens is that as these beings are incarnating as reptilians, they're being pissed off. They're sending massive signals of consciousness through the universe, like with their rage that this is happening. The dragon lords still in Andromeda figure out what's going on, and they hold a big council, a big conclave of dragons. They are pissed off. Some of them are literally dying right there and leaving their bodies and going to be incarnated in there to, like, take out more of these humanoids and lead the charge against them for this offense that they've done against them.
Wow.
And there's this whole other dragon tribe who is like, no, that's not the answer. Like, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't understand our ways. They didn't understand that how sacred we hold our blood and our genetics. They didn't know this. And so this whole fleet of dragon beings decides to leave their incarnation as dragons, travel and be born as these humanoids, as Pleiadians, as Shehali, mostly Shehali, and some Pleiadians, some Arcturians, some other species as well. But mainly this group goes and incarnates as Shehali, because that's the first planetary system these reptilian assaults are going at. And so they get born as Shehali and are growing up there to try to stop the onslaught of their dragon brothers and sisters, who are reptilians now, from basically swarming the whole galaxy and wiping out the humanoid races in the Milky Way.
Is this directly related to the Galactic Wars and the Star Wars saga and that sort of thing?
This is the Orion Wars, as some people have translated it, or at least one instance of the Orion Wars. I'm not sure I agree with some of the timelines that people put on some of these things happening, mostly because I generally gauge time by how long it is from one incarnation to the next for my own journey through time. And it doesn't add up quite as much to be millions of years or whatever, which I hear some people saying. So while I may disagree with the timelines, I would say that any translations I've seen of some of the Orion Wars seem to be talking about these events, because these events lead to assaults of multiple planets by these reptilian beings. It leads to the creation of a clone army of Zeta Reticuli to fight them. That's the clone soldiers in Star Wars. It leads to the creation of these massive Death Star-like programming hubs that the reptilians used to program the Zeta clone soldiers, which had chips in their brains, and assault different planets and run these massive robot armies that they used to attack a lot of the planets. And of course, the destruction of those Death Stars would then subsequently lead to the freeing of the Zetas, the destruction of the robot armies, and eventually the restoration of the galaxy. So,
I got so many questions coming to me. Okay, first of all, how does this relate to the part of the brain referred to as the reptilian brain of the human angelic species?
That's a very important question. It's important to recognize that we all have inside of us different aspects of all different kinds of life. Life is not an isolated thing that happens in a petri dish. We are combinations of all the genetic journeys and lessons of all the different species that exist. And inside of our bodies, we have bird features, we've got insect features, we've got, you know, similarities with some kinds of worms. We've got, you know, we've got genetics. I mean, literally, scientifically, I think the current estimate is that like 99.something% of our DNA is shared with almost every other species that we know. There's this tiny, tiny percentage that makes us different. And so, yeah, we have that instinctive, driven, very like limbic, deeper level reptilian brainstem structure inside of our bodies. Now, you know, when you look at this at a deeper level, like, is it reptile or is it dragon? Is it whatever? Well, it doesn't really matter, because the truth is that we're basically, we contain within us that DNA and that genetics as much as anything else. We have dragon genetics inside of us. We have genetics of almost every kind of reptile on the planet inside of us. You know, we have these facets as already a part of us. I think that probably makes sense.
So do you also see the reptilians that are continuing to assault the human species here, are you seeing them more as kind of, as you said, where, you know, they're in these raptor type bodies and they're like this gigantic life force that's been put into more of a humanoid or a smaller container, so to speak, that has caused some deformity or anomalies or a miscreation maybe or a poor evolvement of their DNA or something?
Yeah, I would say that for the most part, what's happened is that due to the way that consciousness, especially traumatized consciousness, forgets aspects of itself when reincarnating, that cycle has happened many, many times for some of these beings that you're referring to, that may be involved with, you know, trying to control this planet, trying to, like, there's a subconscious drive in them to maintain that I'm a master, that I have a different bloodline than the rest of these humans, and they're my slaves. You know, these people are sheep and I'm the herder, you know, and they have these, these ideas, which are, you know, passed even through some of their family bloodlines, which are based on truth. They are based on the fact that they're not human, right? They, originally, they weren't. Originally, they weren't even from this galaxy. But do they remember that? No, they don't, for the most part. And where did the trauma, and because the biggest trauma was having their genetics stolen and then getting incarnated as a reptilian and then being like assaulting the galaxy and then being battled by every other species, is like all these other beings are like, this is not cool. And then the self-perception of shame, of guilt, of evil, like that they are evil in some way. When those things get ingrained, there are psychological disturbances that happen that can last for lifetimes. And until you get back to the original trauma, and this is a big part of my work on the earth right now, and part of my work as being a dragon who's here, who's trying to restore peace within the galaxy and peace on earth, I've realized that, you know, I have in my heart, I have the wounds and I have the pain, and I feel the great, great sorrow of watching my dragon family get split apart and watching a bunch of beings come to this galaxy with rage to destroy. And it still hurts my heart to know that those beings, as much as I have tried, as much as I have wanted to, and so many of my other soul family that has been journeying through these worlds, has tried to bring that back into balance, to heal those traumas, to bring the things back into harmony, we have not been able to succeed all the way through and wake up all of these other, you know, reptilian, draconian, whatever, dragon lords that are still running from the trauma program. But we've also never been able to actually directly communicate to all of them before. And now we actually have the tools to do that. We're on this nice planet where we've got the internet, we've got things, and we actually have an opportunity, I think a greater opportunity than ever before, to help them see their own reflection and to face that trauma and pain and actually have a breakthrough.
That is so phenomenal. I mean, I just love it. When I listened to that original interview, I was like, right on, because there's some sort of solution that's being, you know, we're directing our efforts and our focus towards some possible solution instead of relooping this war game over and over and over through the course of time, as you call it. The other thing I was going to say, for those that do interface with the reptilians, and I get a lot of emails and have had many discussions with this, what perplexes a lot of the light warriors, a lot of the light workers, anybody who is in that position to do so, is many of the ones that they come in contact with, they don't even see an ounce of concern, loyalty, camaraderie, even amongst themselves.
Right.
Like there's no... they don't care if their mother, father, reptilian, their child, their best friend, you know, if they have a best friend, they don't really care. They're just, their one sole goal is to try to kill us. And so, you know, to me, that reeks, some sort of, something has snapped and gone awry for any species out there.
Yeah, and I honestly, I imagine that that's the case for some, and I honestly, for others, I don't think even the goal is to kill. I think the goal is to, I think there's even a distorted idea that what they're doing is also trying to create some kind of peace or balance by somehow controlling enough of the crazy humans that they can run this world and, you know, put themselves in enough conditions where they can live and back in their dragon thrones and be rocking it and have all the slaves working for them, doing what they need them to do. You know, the reptilian kind of distortions that they had at that time. And, you know, and then, you know, if there's silly humans having chaos and anarchy or whatever, that's not really a big deal. You know, it's like, there's ways that we can see and relate to these consciousness patterns, and it's important for us to be able to honestly look at them and honestly look at these aspects. Because just like you said, you know, we've got a reptilian brainstem inside of us. Every single human does, you know? And the reality is that until we can accept these shadow parts of ourselves and realize you've got aspects of those shadows in you. It doesn't matter if you've been incarnated as the highest heavenly Pleiadian being all your lives. I mean, it might be weird, you know, it might seem strange, but if you're here and you're in a human body, you're in this field with us. And the reconciliation requires that, you know, just like every avatar, every great spiritual teacher on this planet has said, you must come to love your enemies as yourself. You must come to understand that the darkest things you see, the darkest evil that you see, is a darkness that is part of you. It's part of your own fear. It's part of your own judgment and belief that you're separate from source. It's a spell that some people get caught under, and it can be cleared, and it's possible to clear it. And this goes back to the time and the work that we did in Avalon, because we realized that, you know, we couldn't just, you know, as we built this connection, as we built this Camelot, as we built this city of light, in order to bring the wisdom of the light, the wisdom of consciousness, of truth, of honor, of respect, of justice, of balance between masculine and feminine, of sword and chalice to the lands, the honoring of the dragon, the honoring of the wisdom of the earth, you know, and the honoring of our lineages and the honoring of everyone's lineage coming here and being here. As we were doing that work, it became critical to realize that we're not going to defeat these barbarian raids. We're not going to defeat these Viking-like characters from coming in and raiding our land just by like going at them with force. We have to understand them. We have to help them understand us. And we actually made peace with them because we met them with truth and integrity. We met them on the grounds of battle, and we showed them that we were not going to back down, but that we wanted them to see who we were, and we want to see who they are. Right. And through meeting them where they were, we discovered they're not evil, dark, you know, demonically charged beings coming at us. They had just had certain kind of programming in their culture that was different from ours. And yeah,
Adam, I can't agree with you more. I actually had a lovely lady contact me months and months ago, and her sole goal is to really start focusing on what we call the dark and assisting the planet in coming to more of a healing relationship with them, so there's not like an us versus them.
Yeah.
If that's possible, right? Which I think right. Anything's possible. And, you know, there are many of us that have seen battalions of reptilians that have come in to significantly assist the human race, big yeah. time. So, you know, we tend to, you know, throw everything into the pot. Mm-hmm. When in fact, there's all different types of reptilian races, apparently, you know, and different right. pockets of them throughout the universe. And not all of them are the ones that we're kind of up against, okay, here. Yeah. In
a little traumatized.
Yeah. So, you know, and the other thing is, if you stood in their shoes, depending on how they perceive our world leaders, right. My God, of course they're going to think we're absolutely ridiculously stupid.
Yeah. Well, when you're pulling the strings behind the Bush administration, you know, you probably got a lot of laughs.
Right.
Because you're
like, got, yeah, well, they're looking at the whole Nazi, you know, just that whole Nazi propaganda that's just infiltrated the whole political world stage.
Yeah. So let's bring this back again to the kind of focus of our session today, which is this journey through Avalon. And it's really kind of critical that we've talked about these pieces, because understanding how trauma affects people is critical to understanding what went down in Camelot. Like, we achieved an amazing golden age of prosperity and peace among the lands. We made peace with the barbarians. We started trade. We had such richness. We unified all of the different kingdoms, you know, across the British Isles. It was amazing what we were able to accomplish. But, you know, at some point in that journey, somewhere in the cycles when everything's like the bliss is dying down a little bit and stuff is getting a little more complicated, you know, and there's a love affair between Arthur's wife, Guinevere, and Lancelot. And then there's a revelation in which Arthur discovers, you know, that he has a daughter somewhere. And then there's a revelation after that that comes in which Arthur discovers that he's born a child with his sister and that he was lied to, you know, and that, you know, basically, Mordaes, you know, is like, didn't tell him the truth either for all that time. And it's like, and she knew, and here's this, like, you know, it's like, you've got Morgan, you've got Mordaes, you've got the dynamics, you've got Arthur having this meltdown. It's like,
lots of conflict.
The guy who's the leader here now is supposed to, like, forgive his best knight for sleeping with his wife while realizing he has a daughter he hasn't been with his whole life that he needs to find, while finding out that he slept with his sister and had a child, that the women that set that were had been orchestrating this process knew and didn't tell him, and his own sister didn't tell him. And it's like, inside of this golden structure, this beautiful thing, there is suddenly cracks and splinters like crazy. And the trauma, the feeling, the emotion, it's like the feeling of betrayal was so massive and so enraging. And, you know, Arthur was massively upset. The knights were pissed off. It was like everybody wanted the women out of there, you know, and you've got Christianity coming in saying witches, witches, you know. And you've got Guinevere trying to bridge with the Christians, and she's kind of Christian, and it's like, and then it's like, ah, and then the declaration that the dragon is evil, and then it's like, all this stuff is coming down on you because it's who you are, and you are evil beings, you know, and it's like the fear and the trauma and the challenge becomes this just massive splintering space where, you know, and for Arthur, it's like he's literally holding the field for the land and holding the field for the castle. And it's because he's been being given that energy circulation point in the Taurus. And the knights are also holding that circle of that Taurus with him. And so as these splinters start happening and people are pissed at Lancelot and he's pissed and then he's like going to leave, and it's like, everything is falling apart at the same time. And it's all because of these little lies and these little traumas that, when they get revealed, have this feeling of such betrayal. You can imagine that it echoes that same betrayal that the dragons felt when the Arcturians stole their DNA. And here we are at the same time on the other side of that experience, trying to somehow hold things together while being the ones feeling so betrayed yet again, you know?
And I was going to say, Adam, it is so paralleled, no matter what race you are, star nation you are, we are all feeling betrayed. Every single person on the planet feels betrayed. And, you know, if you went through it from a position of psychology, a lot of us, one of the core issues that a psychologist will comment on is that betrayal feeling that God has abandoned you because of that separation. You know, there's some of us that feel betrayed because we know a lot more now. We're more aware that there are these are star nations, et cetera. And why aren't we receiving more assistance? There's a perception that maybe we're not getting as much assistance as we were led to believe we were going to receive. I mean, there's betrayals on so many different levels. But what I wanted to ask you before you go into that, and by the way, we have about 10 minutes, okay. Is going back to Guinevere. Okay, now Arthur represents Pendragon, right? Yes. So Guinevere's father was Leo de Grance. Is that how you say it, I think? Leo de Grance.
Close enough.
And, you know, Leo, lion, you know, I was wondering what was her representation of her bloodline?
Yeah, well, I think that she was bridging. She's bridging a lot of the Lyran wisdom and the other layers of the consciousness coming in, trying to also be a reconciliation point. I mean, Arthur and Guinevere's marriage and coming together was not necessarily a marriage out of them being in love with each other. It was a marriage out of understanding that. You know, there was a role that they could play together to unite certain peoples on the land that otherwise would never have come together.
Yeah.
It was part of the peacemaking circle. And it was obvious. It was clear to everybody, you know, within the inner circle of their world that it was the right choice. And, you know, and for both of them, it was like, the decision was, and they had made a decision a long time before that to be in service to the people above being in service to themselves.
Right. They were planetary consciousness people.
Yes.
And the other thing I was going to bring up was Guinevere. I looked up the translations through the Welsh, and it's translated as the white enchantment of the white fairy, which I thought was very interesting. And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, she supposedly was very strong in alchemy, but she was also supposedly very involved and saw the Catholic faith.
That's right, yeah. And I think it was like, as some of the southern, especially some of the southern nations, you know, within the larger British Isles, you know, when I say nations, I mean more like prefectures, you know, lordships and dukedoms and stuff like that. Christianity really came in strong first from down there. And I think in her family, it was already being brought in, and it was like a way through the darkness, because it was very dark and it was intense. And I think the goal was seen that Christianity could somehow unite people and be, you know, be a refuge from that darkness. And the people that applied it well at that time really saw it as that, as a key. And for Arthur, you know, when Arthur and Guinevere were brought together, it was obvious that that needed to happen also, that the old ways and the Christian ways had to somehow bridge and make peace. And what better way to do that than to be in a loving, you know, harmonious relationship, and to show that bridging happening to everyone, to be able to create that peace. I don't think anybody knew that the kind of the Christian influences would continue to try to insidiously, like, you know, claim that everything the whole dragon wisdom, basically, and the knowledge of the women of Avalon and the knowledge of the magic would continue to kind of insidiously claim that that's the source of all of the problems and that's the source of all the trauma. But you can bet that when Arthur felt betrayed, and you know, during that period of time, that Arthur was questioning all of that too. You know,
sure,
I mean, it was
sure.
Massive questioning.
So you know, that's really interesting, because basically their union was a representation of the attempt to unify the old world with the new world. So the
that's
old
right.
world being the dragon, the fae, the Syrian, the druid, type of culture and environment versus the Christian. Now, when you say Christianity, you were referring probably primarily to the Catholicism, right? Because that was primarily the church at that time, was it not?
Sure. Yes, sure.
So now it is said that her father gave Arthur the Round Table and 100 knights or something. And I wanted to know what you thought about the significance of that.
Well, there was certainly a merging of armies, but the Round Table itself, you know, there's an object that was a round table, that was a big, beautiful, amazing mirrored table that was like a beacon of light. And then there's also an energy that was created. And the energy of the Round Table is actually it's the vesica between the priestesses and the knights that forged this sword and chalice alliance that formed a truly balanced, amazing council, and a council in which, you know, sure, there's leadership in the council, but the leadership is passed from one person to another based on the event, based on the wisdom, based on the challenge at hand. And Arthur and Aura were stewards for that circle. You know, they were real leaders because they held space for the emergence of whatever needed to occur and whatever needed to happen. Now,
a question before you go on. Okay. Do you, in your work, have you seen the Round Table as actually being strictly the knights, or did you actually see it as the knights and the high priestesses sitting as one?
Oh, there were knights and priestesses. And the actuality is that many of the priestesses married the knights, and many of the knights were lovers with priestesses. And so, and the knights would always have women with them. And there were times when the women in Avalon were more present in that circle. But during the time after this betrayal surfaced, things got really rough. And there was splits between a lot of the men and the women, the men and the men. There was like, and the Round Table became much smaller again, and was a core of men that stuck around Arthur during this time of this great pain. And during this period, the land gets really sick. There are illnesses that go through. There was a lot of clear reflections that were like, okay, the center point of this pillar of light has just been massively disturbed, and some stuff is really melting down here, and there's a lot of old karmic stuff and sanskaric stuff coming up. And this is a really, really key juncture to talk about, which I'm glad, you know, we have a couple more minutes to really focus on this.
Because we can always pick this up with the next one, so no worries.
Yeah, this is really the coming of the full circle back to the understanding of the Grail and the importance of the chalice. And with all of this breaking, you have to really look at the fact that a lot of the betrayal and a lot of these feelings and experiences happen between the masculine and the feminine. For Arthur, it was his sister lying to him. It was Vivian lying to him. It was the high priestesses lying to him. It was the woman that he bore a daughter with never seeking him out and telling him, you know, like, how could these women not do this? And then for the other knights, how could you betray me and not tell him? And, you know, and then, you know, you've got, and you know, Guinevere making love with Lancelot while Arthur, you know, understood that they weren't married for love, and it wasn't like that much of a betrayal, you know, really, at all. To the other men, it was,
God, I didn't even think about that. That's a good point. Well, because in the Mists of Avalon, Adam, it shows them having a menage a trois.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it wasn't a menage a trois. He just kind of hung out. So that, that she could supposedly receive the seed of Lancelot and bear a son.
Yeah, well, you know, there's good translations, and there's some things that get off on every story.
I'm curious what you thought about that.
Things. I mean, I don't know of anything like that that went down at that time. It was intense at the time. let's just put it that way. And there were plenty of menage a trois, but not necessarily between those three.
Okay.
And, you know, but the men were pissed, and priestesses were pissed, and the ship was in meltdown mode. And the thing was, is as the land got sick and the place went into darkness, as, you know, Mordred is growing up and it's like clear that, like, look, mom, you know, look what he's doing. He's this supposed pillar of light is now destroying all the land because they're having a meltdown on the inside and they can't hold the field. And now look at the land, look at what's happening. Mordred is stepping up as like, I'm going to take him down, you know? And there's this zone where it's like Arthur and the group there realizes that they have to do something. They have to recover this whole mess. And the way is through forgiveness. And the way is through somehow reclaiming the divine feminine and honoring the divine feminine again and bringing it back. And so there's a quest for the Grail. And the quest is to go and to find and to understand what is the key to healing the kingdom. What is the key to healing the heart of Arthur? What is the key to bringing these wounds back together? And in this journey, you know, which is a whole long story of its own, the answer that eventually comes is that the truth, which is divine love, which is grace, is the answer. And the Holy Grail, the Grail is the symbol, which we know is also carried in this Christian, you know, connection, and this is there as this symbol of this way, this chalice that can hold the energy of the divine and the energy of love. And that if you can but drink of the divine love, then all can be healed and all can be forgiven. And so the emergence of the Grail Knight, where, you know, a knight is brought out of deep seclusion in which he's studied for ages and ages. Ages and ages meaning years and years, or, you know, many, many years, years, right, whatever.
Hey, time is relative.
Yeah, as
and
he's
we
in
are,
this,
we are running out of time, by the way. So
yeah, that's fine. As he's in this seclusion, you know, he discovers some of these keys to unlocking divine grace, the city of grace inside of beings. And in the right time, he comes and he brings these lessons to Camelot and to Arthur and to the knights that are there. And there begins to be a reconciliation, where the men go to find the women and to reclaim, to bring circles back and to start doing this healing. And it's a damn good thing that that started happening, because little did they know Mordred is building an army and wow, he's going to come and attack. And they had to pull it back together again, right, just to be able to make peace and heal the land again.
Well, so can we talk about that next time?
Sure.
Go to phase three.
All right.
And, delve into the grace, delve into the wounds, the way it was brought to the surface, how it's to be healed, how it reflects what's going on today in our world. And Adam, you're just awesome. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to assist us. And I just want everyone to once again remember, it's guardianalliance.net. Correct?
Sure, yeah, or just guardian.is will take you there.
Guardian.is. Okay, there you go. And
just Google Guardian Alliance. I think we come up first, so.
Yeah, you're not going to find it really anywhere else, right? Yeah. And anyway, I hope you guys are enjoying this as much as we are. And stay tuned for our next segment, and we'll see you on the next time. And thanks again, Adam. Awesome. This was very
interesting. Pleasure.
Okay, everybody, take care and stay tuned. Like I said, we've got all kinds of announcements coming up next week. So sending all of you lots of love as always. And just remember to continue to ground the light. Grounding the light. Okay? Talk to you soon. Lots of love.